As the Jews, we have, as we know, numerous days on the calendar year on which we commemorate one thing or another, positive events, negative events, joyous events, sad events. But it's important for us to understand that our tradition does not believe simply in looking back at events of the past, commemorating days of yore, tales of the past, but rather our tradition wants us to associate with these events, to identify with them, and to make them part of our own lives. This is most pronounced on Pesach, the night of Pesach, when in the Haggadah we actually relate to the passage in the Mishnah. It says in Maseches Pesachim, "B'chol dor v'dor chayav adam liros es atzmo ke'ilu hu yotzei Mitzrayim." In every generation, the Jews are required to view themselves as though they personally, each person should look at himself or herself as though he or she personally came out of Mitzrayim, ke'ilu hu yotzei Mitzrayim. Shenemar v'osama hutzim yisham, etc. We've all been redeemed from Egypt, and part of the mitzvah, probably the most challenging mitzvah, this is not the time, but probably the most difficult mitzvah on Pesach night, is not to eat matzah, not to eat maror, but rather to try and relive the experience as if it happened to us. It's difficult to do that because I imagine most of us never were in Egypt. Anyone of us who may have been there were there as tourists, I suppose. We certainly didn't experience enslavement, and therefore it's hard to reimagine or recreate something you didn't experience. So the whole purpose of the Seder is to kind of recreate that experience through talking about it. But this is not limited to the Seder. On Tisha B'Av, we're also required to, in effect, consider the events of the Churban not as something that happened thousands of years ago, centuries ago, the first Beis HaMikdash, second Beis HaMikdash, but actually to view it as though it just happened. Where do I get that from? Because the Chazal tell us that in any generation in which the Beis HaMikdash was not rebuilt, it's considered as if it were destroyed in that generation. And so since thus far, we have not seen the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash, so then it means that we're to consider it as though it were just destroyed. It's not right, it's inaccurate for us to say, well, you know, this happened so many years ago, what's it got to do with me? It certainly has very much to do with me and with you. And again, the fact that the Beis HaMikdash has not been rebuilt is indicative of the fact that had it been standing up until this point, it would have been destroyed in our time. So the idea is on Tisha B'Av as well. And there are a lot of interesting parallels between Pesach and Tisha B'Av. Just on a calendar note, Pesach is always the same day of the week. The first day of Pesach is always the same day of the week that year of Tisha B'Av. This year, as we recall, Pesach, the first Seder was Friday night. Friday night Shabbos was the first day. So Tisha B'Av is Friday night Shabbos. It just so happens that we didn't observe Tisha B'Av because it was Shabbos. We pushed it off. But Pesach is always whatever day you're trying to plan ahead. You want to know when Tisha B'Av is. So whatever night is the first night of the Seder, that's the night of Tisha B'Av every single year. In fact, I mentioned during the kinnis this morning, there are those who suggest that there is a certain tinge, if you will, of avelus, of mourning, even on Pesach night at the Seder. That majestic, grand Seder table has a tinge of avelus. The Ramah mentions that the egg, the beitzah that's on the plate, on the Seder plate, is reminiscent of the egg that serves as a food, Rachmana Litzlan, somebody's an ovel, person returns from the cemetery, you have a meal called the Sudas Havro, the neighbors provide a meal, and the tradition is to eat an egg. An egg is a traditional food associated with avelus with mourning. And he says that on Pesach night, we're also, what are we mourning on Pesach night? We're mourning the fact that a very significant piece of the Seder experience is missing on Pesach night, namely the Korban Pesach. And we have matzah in replace it. We have matzah in its own right. We have matzah as a replacement for the Korban Pesach. But, you know, Pesach night, we're missing a very, very important ingredient, the Korban Pesach. Others disagree. The Vilna Gaon so famously disagrees. He says, Chas v'Shalom, to inject any note of avelus at the Seder. But anyway, there is such an idea. And one of the most, I don't want to say beautiful, I guess it is beautiful, but most dramatic, in my opinion, of the kinnos that we recited this morning, is the kinno that contrasts departing Mitzrayim with departing Yerushalayim. Eish tukad b'kir, each stanza ends with the phrase, b'tzeisi Mitzrayim, as opposed to b'tzeisi Yerushalayim. And it contrasts, and it says that when we came out of Mitzrayim, there was a divine protection, and then came out of Yerushalayim, there was we were ignored by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the whole kinnah, very beautiful kinnah. So on Tisha B'Av also, we're supposed to view as though we just personally experienced this. And that's also hard to do, because we never saw the Beis HaMikdash, and we struggle every single year to figure out how we can make the Chorban HaBayis something that is relevant to us. I don't have the simple answer, but what I'd like to discuss today, in the time that we have, is something a little bit in a different vein than I normally have in the past years. I think this class in the afternoon of Tisha B'Av has been going on for over 20 years for sure. And I generally take a subject in Jewish history which relates not necessarily to Tisha B'Av on the terms of the calendar date, although some did, but others just relate to Tisha B'Av as many of the kinnahs do, because they describe, or the events that took place are events which were tragic for the Jewish people, and we explored various different persecutions and various different events over the course of the years. And what I'd like to discuss today in terms of Polish Jewry sprung from the fact that I had the privilege in the end of March, after Purim and before Pesach this year, the beginning of April, end of March, to spend the 10 days in Poland. I'd never been before. Perhaps some of you have been there before. And to see things from a perspective that I never saw before. Like most of the people in this room, I'm American, born and raised. And I grew up here in Teaneck. But, of course, I went to Yeshiva Day School, Yeshiva High School, and we studied about the Holocaust. And by the way, I'll note that in all these years, I never spoke about the Holocaust. It just once about the Scandinavian countries, the Holocaust didn't happen. But I never addressed that. Maybe another year we will. I never really spoke too much about the Holocaust in these classes. But having gone to Poland, as I did in the end of March, beginning of April, with a group of students from Yeshiva University High School, from MTA, where I served as a Yeshiva, so I had a different perspective. As I said, I grew up here in the United States, and I read about the Holocaust, and I saw films just like I imagine everybody else here has to one extent or another. I'm sure some of us may have delved into it in greater depth, some in lesser depth, but we're all aware. And somehow, being there hit me in a way which I really wasn't expecting, to be honest. I thought of Poland, and it's not necessarily inaccurate, as we'll see, in effect, as a large Jewish graveyard. There is a pasuk that we learned in the Haftarah this morning. And somehow, you know, picturing in my mind, before I went to Poland, the Polish countryside, it's this verse that came to mind. Kiala, the pasuk is in appears in the Navi Yirmiyahu, which is the source of the Haftarah, is in Perek Tes, Pasuk Chav. Kiala mavis b'chaloneinu bo barmanoseinu l'achris olo michutz b'achur merchavos. Death has ascended through our windows. It has come into our palaces to cut down infants from the marketplace and young men from the streets. And that's, I thought, was a passage that aptly describes the Jewish experience, not only in Poland, but wherever the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, reigned and held sway in Europe, that they would come into the homes, the palaces and homes, and grab little children from the marketplace and youngsters from the street. And Daber, Pasuk Kafala, Daber Konum Hashem, Benoflam Niblas Ha'odom Kedomen Al Pnei Hasoda, Uchomir Me'achre Ha'kotze Ve'ein Ma'asev. Speak thus of the words of Hashem, human corpses will fall like dung on the open field and like a sheaf behind the harvester, and none shall gather them up. And that's what I thought was, I say, an apt description of what I thought was true of Poland and much of Europe, places where people died, people were shot, people were killed, and I say a mass graveyard. And to a great extent, that's true. To a great extent, that's true. And I'll give you a parallel which I think is worth considering shortly. But first, before we get to that, a little bit of background about the history of the Jews in Poland. And that's a subject, massive subject. But just a brief overview. It's difficult to accurately determine exactly when Jews first arrived in Poland. First of all, it's difficult to define Poland, because Poland actually went through numerous partitions and was taken over, whether it was ruled by Austria, it was ruled by Prussia, it was ruled by Russia. This part, you know, in the 1770s, 1772, 1775, 1795, the partition of Poland, the first partition of Poland, the second partition of Poland, the third partition of Poland. Poland was one of these places that was always under some other reign. I mean, someone once told me that his grandfather lived in four different countries, but he never left the same house. Right? You know, so, because, you know, every other year it was under somebody else's control. Or the, you know, the joke about the person who was, you know, was living in and told one day that we're no longer part of Russia, we're now part of Poland. And responded, good, I'm glad to hear that, because these Russian winters are impossible. But the reality is that Poland is sometimes difficult to difficult to define because the borders are different. I went, one of the museums we went to just showed that, just again, I knew this but didn't know it till I saw it. And you just see areas which are no longer, especially after the fall of the Soviet Union, things are further complicated. But to define Poland as that kingdom in Central Europe, so it's difficult to determine exactly when Jews first arrived there. According to most, they were there by the 8th or 9th century. Okay, that's, you know, more than 1,000 years ago. According to some, and again, there's dubious records and not everything is accurate, but a charter was given to Jews in 905, permission to live in Poland. In fact, there's a legend, the Ramo, actually, one of his tshuvas, the Ramo is a great luminary of Krakow, we'll get to him momentarily. The Ramo writes in a tshuva, there was a play on words that Jews were searching for a place, they were leaving, they were running away from the Crusades, and they came, and somehow they got a heavenly message or a piece of paper or something which said on it, Po Lin. Here you shall sleep. Lino Pohalada. Po Lin. Rest here, stay here. Poland. Poland is Po Lin. And the truth of the matter is, Jews, to a great extent, were welcomed into Poland. We do have coins with Hebrew inscriptions from the late 1100s. Okay, coins that were found in Poland with Hebrew inscriptions. It appears that Jews were in the coin-making business. They were coiners. And so that we have. And it would appear that in the wake of the Crusades, again, many of the kinnis this morning focused on the Crusades, in the wake of the Crusades, which began in 1090, there were several Crusades, you know, began in the 1090s, so Jews fled eastward and came to Poland. There's records of a Jewish cemetery in 1283, the Jews buying land for a cemetery in 1283 in the city of Plotsk, which means that the community was organized enough by 1283 to be able to afford to purchase land for a cemetery. So there are early roots of the Jews in Poland. For a great deal of time, the Jews enjoyed relative success in Poland. I say relative success because Jews everywhere were always persecuted, and they were always anti-Semites, and they were always people who, you know, didn't like Jews because they didn't practice the religion. Poland is a religious Catholic country and so on to this day. And so there was always, you know, but comparatively speaking, Jews were successful economically. Many came over from Germany. They were in the money lending industry, as many Jews in the Middle Ages were. On the whole, Jews did reasonably well. Yes, there was church hostility. And from time to time, there were pogroms, of course, you know, instigated by the church. There was also jealousy of the Jews' economic success. When the Black Plague, so-called Black Death, ravaged most of Europe, so Jews were a convenient scapegoat, and this happened in Poland as well. But overall, if we consider the 1500s, and I'm going to read now from the Ancient Jewish Encyclopedia on page 567 of volume 10. I don't think you can get this anymore. It's the Yarshin from my grandfather. It says, the Jewish population of Poland was at that time greater than that of any other European country. We're talking in the 1500s now. The Jews enjoyed an extensive communal autonomy based on special privileges. They were not confined in their economic life to purely subordinate occupations, as was true of their Western co-religionists. They were not engaged solely in petty trade and money lending, but carried on also an important export trade, leased government revenues and large estates, and followed the handicrafts and, to a certain extent, agriculture. In the manner of residence, they were not restricted to ghettos like their German brethren. All these conditions contributed towards the evolution in Poland of an independent Jewish civilization. Thanks to its social and judicial autonomy, Polish Jewish life was enabled to develop freely along the lines of national and religious tradition. The rabbi became not only the spiritual guide, but also a member of the communal administration, a civil judge, and the authoritative expounder of the Jewish law. Rabbinism was not a dead letter here, but a guiding religio-judicial system. For the rabbis, a judge civil as well as certain criminal cases on the basis of Talmudic legislation. So there was a certain amount of autonomy, there was economic success, and so on. One of the greatest of the figures of Poland, I mentioned this to the Talmidim, and I'd never really reflected on it carefully till going. But all of us who are of Ashkenazic background in terms of our tradition, the term of Minhagim, everything that we have as Ashkenazim, not everything, most of what we have as Ashkenazim is from Poland. Yes, those who come from a strict German background, the Breuers, you know, Yekesher background and so on, have different Minhagim, but the standard Ashkenazic Minhagim are those codified by Rav Moshe Isserles, the Ramah, in the Shulchan Aruch, and that's what we turn to. I mean, I was deeply moved to be able to be in the Shul of the Ramah in Krakow, which is there today. It's actually a pretty small shul right now. They're fixing things and so on. But I was in the shul, and I chose at that time to relate to the Talmidim a tshuva from the Ramah, which actually was based on a case that came up in his shul, in the shul. It was an interesting story. Again, it's Tisha B'Av, so we don't learn on Tisha B'Av, just very briefly what the case was. There was a situation with a young lady was supposed to get married. She was an orphan, and there was a brothers involved, and so on. And the wedding was supposed to take place. It gives you an interesting picture. The wedding was supposed to take place on Friday afternoon. Now, most of us don't have weddings around here on Friday afternoon. You hear the reason why they had weddings on Friday afternoon. You get a picture of what it was for some people. The weddings were on Friday afternoon because many people could not afford to have a feast for a wedding and food for Shabbos that week. So therefore, they had the weddings Friday afternoon. And the Friday night, Shabbos dinner, doubled the Shabbos dinner and the Suda for the Chasana. In any event, the Ramah writes in the Tshuva, and again, we're not going to go into the details now, what his lumdus was and so on, it's inappropriate for Tisha B'Av. However, there was as sometimes comes up, there was a last minute snag between the families and so on, and suddenly someone decided it was Ois Shidduch, meaning that they were going to cancel the wedding and so on and so forth. And the Ramah had been one of the people who worked on putting it together and so on and so forth, and the Ramah basically said, it was Friday afternoon, it's almost Shabbos, and the Ramah basically held up davening on Fridays. We're holding up the davening until this is going to work out. And he worked it out. And he published a tshuva, explaining afterwards. Someone wants to hear, I can give you the reference to where to look it up if you want to read it in further detail. In any event, this took place in the Ramos shul. So I said to the Talmidim, I thought it was an appropriate subject to explore while we were standing there, sitting there in the Ramos shul. And to me, it was a very moving thing because, you know, as somebody who has had the privilege, you know, to learn, and to learn Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah. It's like, I felt like, you know, there are other great Talmid Chacham and great Rabbonim, but the Ramah is my Rebbe. I mean, anytime you look up any Shaili, you have to see, for an Ashkenazi, what does the Ramah say? You know, and here I am in the place where he lived. So Ashkenazic tradition, the Yesh Nog in the Ramah, and he writes that this is the custom which we today, all of us who come from and follow Ashkenazic tradition, everything springs from the Ramah. So there we are. In Poland was the source of what our practice is today. Those who come from an Ashkenazic background. Okay, when you go, you know, it was also moving to be in Tzfat in the Beis Yosef Shul. Yosef Karo wrote the Shulchan Aruch. I'm not taking away, but again, there are more. I'm an Ashkenazic background, and that's a tremendous, you know, it's unbelievable. Many of the original Hasidim, those who come from a Hasidic background, also from Poland. And normally Melech, you know, we were at his kever and so on. This is all Poland. Much of what we are today as an Ashkenazic community, again, I'm not denigrating anybody else, but the Ashkenazi community, to a great extent, springs from Poland. The Ramah wrote about Poland. While not everything is great all the time economically, he writes and publishes one of his tshuvas as a side remark. The Ramah writes that it's better to eat dry bread in Poland, where it's safe to live, than to have better conditions in some of the other lands where you never know what's going to come next. So again, that's what the Ramah understood that. Of course, in the 1600s, 1648, 1649, the years Tach V'Tat, the Khmelnytsky pogroms and so on, and you know, it was obviously a disaster, but the Jewish community recovered from that as well. By 1890s, the Jews were 34% of the population of Warsaw, which was the big city of Poland, 32% in Lodz. Jews were a noticeable percentage. I mean, New York City area, I think the New York City general area, I don't know the statistics exactly, you can Google them, but I think we're about 10%, you know, and that's in New York. That's the New York area, not more. More than 30% of the Jews, of the population of Warsaw by the late 1890s were Jews, and large. After World War I, when Poland became independent, we'll get to that in a moment, okay, the Jews in 1921 were more than 10% of the entire population of Poland. Now contrast that to the United States. We're about 2.2%, I think, Jews in the United States of America today. Again, we're living here in the New York area, so we're more noticeable. But talking about the overall population of the country was more than 10% Jewish. Just staggering, a staggering number. That means, you know, lots of Jews everywhere. And that's exactly the way it was. Now, after World War I, the Poles attained sort of unexpectedly independence. And, you know, that had good things, it had bad things. The Jews hoped that you know, it would give them even more success and more autonomy, you know, but more nationalism. But nationalism sometimes takes a different tone, those of students of history know, and the Jews didn't always do well with nationalism. But again, just in terms of the populations, now after World War I, cities like Bialystok, Grodno, Brest-Litovsk, known in some circles as Brisk, okay, had over 50% of the population of the city was Jewish. Pinsk was over 70% Jewish. We visited a place when I was there, and I can't remember the name. It was not a famous city. I don't remember the pronunciation. But they told us that before the war, before World War II, this city was 90%, the town, it wasn't a city, the town was 90% Jewish. Jews were a noticeable minority, a noticeable population in Poland. Now, in between the two world wars, there was something called the Polish peasant movement. The Jews were in the way because they had jobs, and of course, other people wanted those jobs. Jews, by the way, lived in cities, not only in, you know, they were concentrated to a great extent in the urban areas. Okay, and the Polish peasant movement, I'm reading now from a book, there's a book entitled The Jews of Poland Between Two World Wars. It's a compilation of articles from different people. And this is an article from a professor named Wynoff from the University of Florida. It was published about 25 years ago. Anyway, he writes, in view of the fact that historical circumstances, this was a quote from a list of the laws or the desired laws from the peasant movement. In view of the fact that historical circumstances have not permitted the Polish nation to develop its own middle class, which could take over as trade and credit intermediaries, and these social functions have fallen into the hands of the Jewish element, more powerful on a percentage basis than in any other European country, and it's true, okay? Whereas the slogans of assimilating someone that appeared unrealistic, and the Jews in Poland today constitute a consciously alien nation, you begin to see the roots, or expressing the roots of classic anti-Semitism. The most vital interest of the Polish nation and state demand that the above functions pass over in an increasingly greater degree to the hands of the Poles. Now, remember this, as was the case in Germany. This is being written in the 1900s. Jews had lived in Poland for 1,000 years. They didn't just come 2 weeks ago. They were there for 1,000 years, and yet were still not considered to be Poles. That's, again, classic anti-Semitism. Rav Soloveitchik, I've mentioned in past years, Rav Soloveitchik pointed out the Pesach and Parsha Shmos, when the persecution of the Jews begins, the enslavement of the Jews begins under Paro, it says, Ve'ela Shmos b'nei Yisrael ha'boim Mitzrayim. The Jews had just come. They really had just come. They've been there already for generations. They've been there for a couple hundred years already, from Yosef's time. No, they always view them as they just came. The Jews just got here. Here are Jews in Poland for 1,000 years, but they're not Poles. Their rights and their businesses should be taken over and given, passed over in an increasingly greater degree to the hands of the Poles, if they're not Poles. It is necessary to, but listen to this, it is necessary to achieve this not through fruitless acts of violence, which lead to the impoverishment of the nation's soul, but primarily through the development of cooperatives, the organization of producers in contact with consumers, and so on, an entire plan, basically. But again, you see there the, jealousy of the Jews and the treatment of the Jews as being, you know, what we call others. So there is this, again, when nationalism takes over, the Polish peasants and so on, so anti-Semitism rises. There's always anti-Semitism. It's incorrect to assume there was no anti-Semitism in Poland. There always is anti-Semitism, always was anti-Semitism, but Polish nationalism, you know, adopted an anti-Semitic position right from the outset. In the period, I'm reading now from another article by Israel Gutman from the Hebrew University. In the period between the two world wars was the historical tradition of Polish anti-Semitism exerted a considerable influence on the web of relations between Poles and Jews. The negative image of the Jews has been temporarily discredited, okay? But from the turn of the century, turn of the 20th century, until the First World War, the polarization of Jews and Poles increased, Polish opposition to Jews mounted, the negative image of the Jew had been undergoing changes in still another sense. In the past, the image of the Jew was a peddler, an innkeeper, a middleman. Now it became a collective stereotype referring to the Jews as a whole. Here the Jews emerge as wielding enormous power in Poland and the world at large, as representing their own particularistic and national interests, and as devising dark plots against Poland and Christian society in general. We know about the protocols, the Elders of Zion, and so on, the movement, the international Jew who's trying to take over everything. So this, accusation and so on rears its ugly head, certainly in Poland as well. And naturally, when you had different sides, so those who supported side A accused the Jews of being side B. Those who supported side B accused the Jews of being supportive of side A. Right? That was also typical, whether it was the Bolsheviks and whatever else. You know, the Jews were always, those who didn't like Jews accused the Jews always of being on the wrong side, you know, on the wrong side of the equation. So there was certainly that issue of anti-Semitism. It's unclear whether it's really a religious kind of anti-Semitism, although again, Poland is a Catholic country. But nonetheless, you know, this certainly is there in the years leading up to World War I. In 1929, the Catholic festival of Corpus Christi fell on Thursday, May 31st. On the following Sunday, as was traditional, processions of the faithful followed the consecrated host. These processions took place all over the country. One of them was held in Lvov. Lemberg, right? Its route passed along Zygmuntowska Street, where a large private Jewish girls' gymnasium was located. Gymnasium means the high school. As in other private Jewish schools, the girls were in the school because Sunday was a regular school day, right? They were off on Shabbos. It happened that the procession passed the school during a break between two classes, So fair numbers of children were playing noisily in the school courtyard and could be heard in the street. One of the younger girls, in order to get a better view of the procession, stood on a stool and fell down. There was a whole tumult, and people crying and laughing and so on. And those at the back of the procession took these harmless occurrences as a Jewish profanation of the Catholic religion. These Jewish girls are making fun of our parade, they're making fun of our thing. And a number of Catholics gathered at the school and attempted to provoke a disturbance, but were quickly dispersed by the police. And this is referred to as the failed pogrom. There was an attempt, but it didn't happen. It didn't happen. It ultimately didn't happen. People write their newspapers, and newspapers at that time, in effect, defended Jews, said no way it makes any sense that these young girls were trying to. One of the papers wrote in June, the attitude of the Jewish youths involved, even if it demonstrated a lack of respect in relation to the Catholic procession, cannot be regarded as scandalous. It is difficult to believe that young Jewish girls would attempt to provoke a Catholic crowd. That just doesn't make any sense. But it means that people thought about it, even the newspapers didn't buy into it. Again, whether they were defending Jews or just opposing that particular party is a different question. But this was, again, you see it on the surface. The hatred of the Jews is, you don't have to get too far down to come up with that. And yet, at the same time, people pointed out that what did not exist in Poland, the characteristic, you know, when there were pogroms, it was not really endorsed or supported or encouraged, at least officially, by the government, which made it different than what went on in many, many different countries. Of course, as the Nazis rose to power in Germany and their ideology spread elsewhere in Europe as well, these things began to change. And there was more outward hatred of Jews and more of a desire to, you know, purify the country of Jews and the Aryan nation, superior race, and so on, even before the war itself started. These ideas caught on in Poland, as they did in many other places as well. The Jews, however, you know, continued to thrive as a people during and as individuals during that those interwar years. You had religious institutions. You had newspapers. There were. I have a quote over here. I have to find it. I think before the war, I don't know, there were like dozens and dozens of Jewish newspapers in the country. I'll try and find the quote shortly. Right, the Jewish papers and Jewish activity and Jewish political activity and Zionism and all these things flourished in Poland despite this little bit of increasing anti-Semitism. People lived there. Jews, again, were a major part of the population, and they were successful. One thing I saw in Poland, and I was assured, I still don't quite believe it, I was assured it was not meant as an anti-Semitic thing, but you can buy a good luck charm. And what it is somebody wearing traditional Jewish garb. You can see it has a beard and a big yarmulke and tzitzis with the black stripe, and he's sitting and he has in his hand a big coin, a gold coin. And you can buy, they're like this high. You can buy them, and so I was told, investigating, that's a good luck charm for your business to be successful. You know, sometimes people put the dollar bill on the first dollar bill that they make on the wall of the store or something like that, the first $10 bill, right? So here, this was considered to be a good luck charm. Jews are successful. You want to have success in business, get this little statue of a Jew sitting. Again, I was assured, I don't quite believe it, but I was assured this was not meant as something negative, but almost respect, or almost like, oh, Jews are successful, so I want to be successful too. So that was there. You had Chadorim, Shtiblach, but these institutions were clearly flourishing when the war approached. And by the time of the beginning of World War I, the Nazi occupation of Poland, so Jews again were over 10%. You had, by far and away, the largest number of Jews in the world lived in Poland. 3.5 million Jews lived in Poland, 10% of the country's population. 3.5 million is a staggering number. Of the 3.5 million, 3 million or so were exterminated in the Holocaust, so that half of the 6 million were Polish Jews. Half of the 6 million. This gives you they were by far the largest population, and by far those who've been to Yad Vashem will remember at the end to have the list of the countries and then have a number exactly how many people died from each of those countries. So Poland is far and away, far and away the largest amount. One of the unbelievable institutions which rose during the pre-war years, and again, so you had this, there was festering anti-Semitism, but there was also Jewish success. In the city of Lublin, which is one of the large cities in Poland, you had a very important figure by the name of Rabbi Meir Shapiro. Today, he's best known as being the founder of the Daf Yomi movement. The Daf Yomi, he was the one who presented the idea to the Agudas Yisrael Convention in Poland in 1922 to come up with the idea of Daf Yomi, which had become so popular. It was his idea. But aside from that, he had a goal and a desire to build a beautiful yeshiva. In those days, up until then, when you had a yeshiva, so the yeshiva took over the town, it became like a college town in terms of the Jewish population of the town. The yeshiva was there, and where did the boys eat? They basically ate what's called kest. They ate by people in the community hosted them. Much against their desire, by the way. Very often the people in the community were poor by themselves. The last thing they need were two extra hungry yeshiva students, you know, coming to eat by them. They didn't really have what, and they were treated, in some cases treated very poorly, other cases treated, you know, whatever. Who wants extra people coming in and, you know, another mouth to feed and so on? And they did so because there was a yeshiva and it supported the learning and so on. And Meir Shapiro wanted to build something with parallel like university, Lahav, that it would be a beautiful building and the people would sleep in the building. And he created a yeshiva called the Yeshiva Chachmei Lublin. Yeshiva Chachmei Lublin. And he went all over and raised money. And when the Yeshiva Chachmei Lublin was built and dedicated, people came from all over, not only Jews, but Polish officials. And it was a major, major event. The building, Yeshiva Chachmei Lublin, is still there. It still exists. It's a hotel today, actually. It's a Jewish hotel. I'm not sure if it's kosher or not. It's a Jewish hotel. We daven in Yeshiva Chachmei Lublin. I was privileged to give a shir in the Yeshiva Chachmei Lublin in that building to our students. I set over a shekel Torah from Rabbi Shapiro. I happen to have at home a sefer from some chidush from Rabbi Shapiro. So I set over from one of his svarim. I was moving also, again, not the same as in the Ramo, but Rabbi Shapiro is a great Talmud Chacham, but I didn't learn by him, but the Ramo is different. But still, that was a tremendous privilege, and the building is still there, and the building is still visited, and you can see, of course, they've made some renovations, but the building of Chachmei Lublin is still there. The Nazis, by the way, had it in for Lublin in a particular way as well, because they considered it the center of Jewish culture, perhaps even more so than Warsaw. In any event, once the war broke out, again, it was an immediate disaster for the Jews of Poland, and you know, as everywhere, but more so, I guess, more so in Poland, because you know the numbers were simply so staggering. And within the first few weeks, I mean, now from the Encyclopedia Judaica, the outbreak of the war, September 1, 1939, the invasion of Poland by German troops, were marked by immediate heavy loss of civilian, especially Jewish life, and material damage. Military operations caused the death of 20,000 Jews, while bombing destroyed some 50,000 Jews. Jewish-owned houses, Jewish-owned factories, houses, workshops. Okay, some 90% of Jewish homes went up in flames. In Warsaw alone, in the first month of the war, 30% of the Jewish homes were destroyed. In the first 1 month, you know, 30% of the Jewish homes. Jewish loss on the battlefield were 32,000 dead, another 61,000 taken prisoner. This is just at the beginning of the war. This is before, you know, the action, so to speak, against the Jews. So it was really an immediate disaster, and Poland was divided up, and there were different areas, and the systematic robbery of Jewish property, and again, everything we know about from the Holocaust from other countries, so you have to multiply it by numerous amounts, simply because of the staggering Jewish population. And again, eventually 3 million killed. Driving through Poland today, here's what I'd like to share with you. I'd like you to join me for a moment in the use of your imagination. Imagine you're driving in 80 years from now. 80 years from now. Sorry, now, 2016, 2096. You're accompanying a group of high school students on a bus or whatever the mode of transportation will be. And you're driving from Philadelphia to New York. And as you pull out of Philadelphia, the guide tells you that over here was a famous yeshiva at one time. It used to be called the Yeshiva Philadelphia, headed by prominent Talmid Chachamim. Many boys learned here and so on. And they drive a little further through that area of Philadelphia, past Bala Cynwyd, and they point out that there used to be a kosher pizza shop over here, and over there was the shul. And then you drive through Cherry Hill, heading to the New Jersey Turnpike, and they tell you that Cherry Hill had a Jewish community. There was Yeshiva Day School here at one time. And you get on the New Jersey Turnpike, and you drive up the turnpike, and you pass by the Highland Park Edison area, and the guide tells you that over here were several prominent Jewish communities, yeshivas and shuls, some well-known rabbanim lived here. And then you pass through Elizabeth on your way north, and this is a community that was founded by a very prominent Rav and Talmud Chacham, taken over by his son, had a kehillah structure, a community with mikvos and erevin and several different shuls all under this one rabbinic family, boys yeshivas, girls yeshiva, high school, that people came to from all over the area. And then you go further north and you pass by Passaic, and they tell you that here was a thriving Jewish community that actually had a bit of a lull, but then a rejuvenation when more right-wing, for lack of a better term, Jews moved in, a big yeshiva was built there, and the community thrived, and huge numbers of children living here and going to Yeshiva Day School here. And then you pass by Teaneck, and they tell you there was a shul at this corner and a shul at that corner, and there were, you know, 15 Jewish kosher restaurants on this block, and a prominent rabbi lived over here. And that's as you're going through, and what's there now is nothing. None of that stuff. And after you pass through Teaneck, you go over, of course, the George Washington Bridge, and they tell you that here in Washington Heights, there was a university that was also yeshiva, and you had 1,000 students studying here, and minyanim, and talmid chachamim, and great rabbanim, and so on and so forth. And then you get to Brooklyn, you can use the imagination for the rest of the way. That's what it felt like. We can't even imagine such a thing, right? Can you imagine? Can you imagine 80, I'm not talking about 800 years from now, 80 years from now. 80 years from now, driving up from Philadelphia to New York and being told, there used to be here kosher food, there used to be a mikveh over there, this is where there used to be a shul, here's where there used to be a beis medrash, here's where Rav so-and-so used to live, and here's where he said shirim. And now that's there now. And there's almost no remnant, maybe a plaque. And that's what you felt like to some extent in Poland. Traveling through, seeing what used to be and hearing what used to be over here and what used to be over there. And there's nothing there now. You come to Krakow, okay, and that's where we spent Shabbos. We spent Shabbos in Krakow. So Krakow was a city which actually was not real. Was Warsaw was destroyed by the Nazis. The Nazis destroyed the city. Anything in Warsaw that exists today is post-World War II. So you can see the apartment, you know, they put up during the you know, the communist era, the Soviet era, these very drab kind of apartment buildings sometimes see. And newer buildings, that, you know, with brand new buildings with all glass, like New York City kind of buildings and so on. But everything in Poland is post-World War, in Warsaw rather, is post-World War II, because they leveled the entire city. They didn't just destroy the ghetto where there are remnants of the wall. You can still see the Warsaw ghetto wall. But they destroyed the whole city because the Poles revolted. This was a punishment by the Nazis. They destroyed the entire city. So anything in Warsaw is post-World War II. Not so in Krakow. Krakow wasn't really destroyed. The people were taken away. People were killed. Krakow was not destroyed. Krakow is an old city. Krakow is actually, to some extent, the university town. There are a number of universities there. You can see old castles. In Krakow, it's hard for us to relate to it living in the United States. It's more like when we go to Eretz Yisrael. You know, in Krakow, anything after 1800 is called new. This is the new street, the new cemetery, the new, you know, everything after 1800 is new. You know, because you have buildings there from centuries ago. And one of the buildings, which used to be a shul, it's now a museum, you know, with Jewish artifacts in it. I saw it. There is, when you come by the doorway, a big tzedakah box. So you leave the shul, you can put tzedakah into this box, okay? And it said, on the tzedakah box, it was donated by the so-and-so family, and I figured out what year it was, 1407. Okay, those people got their money's worth out of that donation, that's for sure. But Lemaisa, 1407, right? And that makes it, you know, the Ramah shul was 100 years after that, more than 100 years after that. So that's what I'm talking about. That's what you have there, ancient shuls and everything else also. I mean, ancient castles and buildings. So it's very, very different. But anyway, you come to Krakow, and you know, you're traveling from Warsaw to Lublin and to Krakow, as we did, and you hear what once was. So where we ate in Krakow over Shabbos was the building where Sarah Shanira had the first Beis Yaakov. That's the building. The building where Sarah Shanira opened the first Beis Yaakov, and right around the corner, this is where Sarah Shanira lived. You can see where her apartment was. And, you know, she was a seamstress, right? She was, you know, originally, right? But, I mean, you see a simple apartment, and there is a plaque on the building. It's now, the building is owned by a Chassidish fellow who runs a catering establishment for all the people who come to visit Krakow for Shabbos. That's where you eat. That's where we ate also. He has a kitchen and a commissary there and so on and so forth. So, but outside, that was the building. So I said, you know, it's just, you're soaked with Jewish history. When you're just standing there walking on the street, you go to Nechemiah Kornitzer, was the last rabbi of Krakow. You know, I have some of his farm at home. You see these people, you know, in a different light, and you're walking through these experiences. It's something different. However, as much as we, you know, look back on the success, so to speak, of Jews in Poland, you cannot ignore the fact of what happened to the Jews of Poland. And that idea of the cemetery, the Domino Plaza, the bodies being dropped and not having a place and so on and so forth, you know, stands out. In Lublin, I was taken aback when we came to Majdanek, which is the concentration camp that's located in Lublin. Because, you know, again, I've seen the pictures and everybody, like everybody else. But you're driving on the street in Lublin, and it's a regular street, you know, the width maybe of, I don't know, of Ocean Parkway or whatever, you know, kind of a wide street. And, like, all of a sudden, there's the concentration, it's the middle of the city. I mean, it was like, you see a green area, there's like Voti Park. It's the only thing is that they have barracks there. It was just like in the middle of the town. And I, when the bus pulled down, you know, we weren't paying attention, but okay, we're here. I looked out the window, like, I stopped, what? And you could see the Magdanek is still pretty much intact. Okay, you can see the gas chamber when you walk through, but when you get out of the bus, and you know, right across the street, there's an office building, and there's a trolley going. It's like in the middle of the city. It's not someplace outside in the boondocks. It's, you know, it's the middle of the city. It was just striking to me. And people's back, on the other side of the camp, people's backyards. I mean, you know, sort of above the back of the camp. It's hard for me to, you know, I know location, but you know, it's just, it was hard to imagine. And when you walk through the camp and you just see what happened, you can see the gas chambers and you can see, you know, the crematoria. At the end of Majdanek, those who've been know that there's an entire huge, I don't call it like a big well, so to speak, full of human ashes, human remains, human ashes. You can't, it's covered, so you can't, you know. But that's where our group, and this was an amazing thing to be part of, just, you know, it was impromptu. That's the end of the tour of the camp, so to speak. You walk through, you see everything in different rooms, and when you come to there, that's where it ends. And, you know, and then the bus picks you up there and takes you. So there were a number of other groups. We weren't the only ones there at that time. In fact, it was actually that week, happened to be the yard sale of the Norman and Melech. So a number of Hasidic groups were in Poland at that time. So, because they go to his kever on his yard site, right after the week after Purim. Anyway, so there were different groups. Our group, a boys from, you know, from this New York, New Jersey area, University High School. You had the Yeshivish group there. You had the Hasidic group there. There were Israelis. There were young men, young women, you know, the people who wrapped themselves in the flag while they walked through the camp. We've seen pictures of it and so on. And we came to this point at the end. Somebody started singing, and then the entire group is singing. It doesn't matter what your background was. You know, our boys started one song, a different group started a different song. Just songs, Animamin and you know, Achenekol Beis Yisrael, whatever the tunes were. And it was a remarkably moving moment. Something I'll never forget. Just, you know, you're there, you are, you can't help but react. And that's certainly an image of, you know, a poem that you can't forget. And, you know, I went to the concentration camps, of course, the Auschwitz-Birkenau, which nothing prepares you for seeing that, even the pictures. What struck me, anyway, aside from, yes, you know, we saw, you see the sign, Arbeit macht frei, you know, live, so to speak, you see that it's different than seeing it on TV, and on TV on a movie and so on. But what struck me about Birkenau, which is Auschwitz II, was the sheer immense size of the place. It's enormous, it's as large as Teaneck. It's as far as you can see. The whole grass area, you can just, which as far as you can see in every direction, was part of that camp, and they understand, because there were, at one time, it was being built for 200,000 people, so that's the size of a city. It was absolutely, and you're just like, you're dumbfounded. And that was certainly the, you know, the feeling that I had. However, and I mentioned in the title of the talk that we look at the 21st century also. The particular trip that we had was not going to be only a trip to visit the cemeteries and the concentration camps. And we did. That's what it's about. But there's something else as well. Remarkably and inexplicably, and it's a debatable point whether it's a good thing or not, ultimately, there are Jews living in Poland today. There is, to a certain extent, a revival of Jewish life in Poland today. There is an interest in Jews in Poland today. One of the people that we met with, our group met with towards the beginning in Warsaw, was a woman from an organization called the Forum for Dialogue. And she was explaining that what her organization does is they go around Poland to public schools to educate the young generation as to what happened to Jews here, to explain to them and so on that they should be sensitive to it. And subsequently, once they've established a rapport, these, you know, volunteers who go around Poland, once they've established a rapport with the community and with the schools and so on, then work with the towns to make sure that there are ordinances passed not to build any buildings over Jewish cemeteries and so on and so forth. And she was explaining this was her work, and, you know, I was impressed that someone's taking the time for this. And then at the end, when she mentioned that she's not Jewish, I was say that again? You're not Jewish? No, she's not Jewish. She's not Jewish. And we found through that trip quite a fascinating interest on the part of non-Jews in preserving Jewish culture. Now, we can analyze, is it guilt? It's hard to say that it's guilt, because these are not only children, they're grandchildren of the people. They were not part of it. Huh? Right, you can argue that, but there's a fascinating interest. To the point that in Krakow, which I mentioned, you have universities in Krakow, the number of young non-Jewish Polish students who are taking Jewish history courses and Jewish culture courses, it's a ridiculous number. I thought it would make me up. I wouldn't do that if I were Jewish. Why do I care? You know? But I think, and this is, you know, and I presented this to somebody. I think that what it is that Poland, to a great extent, was the patsy of Europe, the patsy country of Europe for so many decades, and so many centuries, really, and did not really have any, any international prestige the way you think about Germany and Prussia and Russia and Austria, Austria-Hungary. Poland was always like the schlep along, so to speak. And now, after the fall of the communist regime, and Soviet Union and so on in 1989 and so on, so for the first time, it's only 25 years that they have an opportunity to develop their own culture. And what some of the people told me is that Jews are part of their culture. Like I said before, they were 10% of the population. There were cities, major cities, where Jews were 30 and 40 and 50% of the population. There's interest from a historical point of view. Well, here's shortly. But I think it's you know, again, does go. I'm not a psychologist and so on, but I really think that there was, and we saw this again and again. I'll tell you an amusing story, because the guides that took us around in certain places were also not Jews, but were thoroughly knowledgeable in the Jewish history of the history of the Jews in Poland. When we were walking on Shabbos afternoon, after we had the meal in the building, it was the Beis Yaakov of Sarashenera, so we had a walking tour of the Jewish area. In fact, they showed us there. You can see where some of the scenes from Schindler's List were filmed in that area and so on. Anyway, so we're walking through Shabbos afternoon and as I mentioned, so that week we were that Shabbos, we were in Krakow, so there were a lot of Hasidim around because they had come to Poland. You have charter flights from America and from Eretz Yisrael to go to Krakow, from there to Lublin, to the Kever of the Enom Elimelech. So we were there too, but I said, I want to go on the yard site because, there were 6,000 Hasidim there that day. And so we went on the day, it was after the yard site, we were able to get up to the Kever. Literally, I'm not joking, there were 6,000 people there. It was set up, they had food set up, and they had, places to stay. It was just really remarkable. But anyway, we were on this walking tour in Krakow in the afternoon, and a Hasidic fellow came up to me and asked me, someone told me that one of these houses, a certain, Siddur Morgan Shemesh lived and so on. Do I know which house it is? So I said, I don't know, I'm not from here. I just got here, I'm part of the tour. So he wanted to ask the guide, but we couldn't remember the person's last name. I knew the Sefer, and I knew, by us sometimes we know the author by the name of the Sefer, right? You say the Mishnah Berurah, right? You say, we know the author, but I couldn't think of the name. And there was another person from YU there with me, and together the three of us were fumbling to try and figure out the name of this person. And finally I said, the first name was Clonimus Kalman, which is not such a common name. So I said, maybe if I say to the guide, the first name, it'll strike a chord, and they'll remember. The guide won't remember. So I said the name. He said, Horowitz, immediately, So one of the boys said to me, there's three rabbis, can't figure out the guy's name, but this non-Jewish tour guide, no. And this was an experience that we had, this kind of thing more than once. There is in Krakow, every year in the summer, a Jewish festival. They have a Jewish festival. It's attended by 25, 30,000 people. What does it mean? They have Jewish food. I'm not saying it's kosher. Okay, but they have, Jewish ethnic food, and they bring in, I saw the program, they bring in, entertainment from Israel, musicians and this, and, classical musicians and rock musicians, whatever it is, they have for several days, they take over the whole thing, and now apparently can also get kosher food there and so on. So we also met with the coordinators of this, the volunteers who were coordinated, we'll get back to them shortly, the volunteers who coordinated this, okay, also, they're not Jewish. Now, yes, there's a buck to be made. I don't take away from that. But still, an interest in, but their interest in Jewish culture, I just found it absolutely fascinating. I don't know, it was something I was totally not expecting. On the Jewish side, there is, through the Lauder Foundation, many of you have heard of the Lauder Foundation, there are Jewish schools now in Poland. We met a young couple, Rav and Mrs. Polak, Mati Polak and his wife, Hadassa. He's originally from Poland himself. He actually came over, I didn't know him from there, but he came over to YU to receive smicha, to study, to become, get his rabbinical degree. And then he went back afterwards, and he and his wife are now the principals of this school in Warsaw, and they have Jewish kids that they're educating. The chief rabbi of Poland is a gentleman by the name of Rabbi Michael Shudrick. You may have heard the name. He's also American, also Muslim Hawaii. Actually, he's been in Poland for more than 20 years. He told us that there are two things that he's very deeply involved in right now. Number one, taking care of Poles who risk their lives to save Jews who no longer have any family to take care of them. He raises money and so on and so forth to help pay back these people. And we actually met with a woman who talked to us. She was a little girl at the time, but she's one of the, Yad Vashem has the Righteous Gentile program. She's on the list. She was in Poland. She came. She only spoke Polish, but somebody translated for us, and she spoke what it was like. She was a little, you know, she was a teenager at the time. Her mother decided to take in two Jewish women, two young Jewish women. I asked, you know, did you know them before? No, someone they didn't know before. They had no relation with before, but they were just moved to take them in. As a girl, she was a kid. She resented it a little bit. As you can imagine, I mean, you know, she resented it. You know, who are these people intruding on my home? A teenage girl, you know, she said how, you know, she didn't particularly like the people, she didn't like them so much or whatever. But nevertheless, they saved Jewish lives. So this Rabbi Shudrick is making sure that people like this, who may not have any families, any money, are taken care of. But number two, he said something else fascinating. The number of people from Poland who are now coming forward, who are saying, we've just found out that I just found out that I'm Jewish, is staggering. What happened? The old grandfather, grandmother just died, and they're going through the papers and going through the house to close up the house, and all of a sudden they find that they're Jewish. Now, obviously during the Nazi period you didn't identify it, and during the communist period you didn't either. And so these people simply, you know, ignored it and so on, and all of a sudden people who are now in their 20s, young men, young women now in their 20s, are suddenly discovering that they're Jewish. And so Rabbi Shudrick told us that he is spending a lot of time checking, is it actually true? Are they Jewish? He's checking records and ksubas and shul records. And you know, it occupies a tremendous amount of time. But there are a tremendous amount of people who were saved, whatever. I mean, there were different ways. They were saved. They were taken to a monastery, whatever it was. Or they simply hid and basically gave up their Judaism or had no choice, but then suddenly discovering they're Jewish. It's, you know, it's again, it's a staggering thing. It's a staggering thing to behold. It was also interesting, I found, that in the years, the weeks rather, we were there, the days that we were there, so I had told the boys, you know, to bring caps and you know, and in many places not to stand out, not to go outside with the yarmulke and so on and so forth. Well, other than the one day when we gave them free time in Krakow, you know, the last day before we left to get souvenirs or whatever, and I told them, it wasn't necessary. And nobody bothered us. And actually, one of the guides told us that right now, he said, you know, it's a lot safer for Jews here in Krakow than in Paris and probably in London also. He said, you know, it's interesting, right now, and I'm not going to say, but, you know, he said there are very few Muslims in Poland, for whatever the reason, at least at the moment, and the Jews are not mistreated. Again, not that there aren't occasional, of course there are, here too it exists. But I mean, overall, he said that the Jews are pretty safe here. And we ate in a restaurant that was kosher and so on, so it's very fascinating to see some kind of revival of Jewish life in Poland. Now, you speak to anybody who himself or herself or grandparents and so on or parents were survivors, came from Polish background, you have nothing nice to say about the Poles, and understandably so. I remember I had a professor when I was in YU, I was a history major, so I had a professor of history who was not an observant man. Not really wore yarmulke respect, but he was a historian. And I remember this was the time when you had the revolutions in Poland, Solidarity, those who remember, you know, Lech Walesa, remember those names, and so on. So, and you know, Poles suffered, there were riots and so on and so forth, and this man said, the Poles deserve whatever they get. And I understand his father, you know, his father was tortured and who knows what happened. And I understand that 100%, and that's how I expected to feel. And to some extent, we know for a fact that there were Poles who collaborated. We know for a fact that after the war, there were Jews who came back to the cities and had their property taken and were killed and everything else. But again, I think somewhat of a remarkable thing to see that there are Jews in Poland today, and there is some interest. In Krakow, there's a JCC, which had a very, very vibrant program of Hebrew language and Jewish cultural activities and so on. It's a thriving program. Again, we can debate this. It's a good thing. You know, you can tell people, why aren't they moving to Israel? You know, I always hate to ask that question because the person says, well, why aren't you moving to Israel? I don't have a good answer myself. So meanwhile, I'm here. So there are people who stayed there after the war. People are there. There are people there for business opportunities or whatever. And that's why you have foundations like the Ladder. I was quite taken. Again, it was just not at all what I expected. And I think that in considering the 21st century, we have to recognize that there are Jews there, and organizations like this Ladder Foundation, the school run by Rabbi Mrs. Pollack, are doing a remarkable thing. Here's an interesting story. As I said, we met this Rabbi and Mrs. Pollack in Warsaw, but we were not in Warsaw for Shabbos, we were in Krakow for Shabbos. So they told us, oh, they're going to be in Krakow for Shabbos with a group, like a Shabbaton, a family Shabbaton. They were going to be in the Krakow that particular Shabbos. Maybe we want to join them. After our Friday night activities are done, we should come join them in whatever hotel they were staying. It's all in the same general area. So, you know, these are high school boys, they don't mind staying up late. So after we finished the Friday night dinner, after we finished our own activities and so on and so forth, Friday night, we had a dish and whatever else. So then we went over there and we had, with their kids, another program where our boys were teaching them Jewish songs, teaching the kids Jewish songs, and they were singing, you know, David Melech Yisrael, and, you know, Lechad Odi, and whatever else. And it was just, you know, remarkable. Here we were sitting in Poland, and they said, well, come tomorrow night, we're taking the kids bowling. Well, we had another activity planned. We actually had arranged for a performance of three Jewish klezmer musicians to play, incredibly talented. But after that, we went to a bowling. This is a bowling alley in Krakow. A bowling alley in Krakow. So we had a kumsitz in a bowling alley in Krakow. I mean, it's just, not again, nothing I anticipated, nothing I would have believed. But that's the life. There is Jewish life in Poland today, and it ought to be considered. Poland is the land of the Holocaust. At one time, it was a land of opportunity for Jews, and it was a paradise for Jews. It became hell. And there's no doubt about it. There's no justifying it. There's no explaining it away. There's no minimizing it. And the truth is, though, and as I said before, you see that description. You know, I gave the example of traveling through in America, and from Philadelphia to New York. You can't help but see that in places we used to have a huge Jewish population, where there's nothing there anymore. And imagine what it once was—the three, the millions and millions of people. But worse than that, still is desolation. You know, the Gemara tells us that when the Chachamim with Rabbi Akiva came to the site of the Mikdash. So it wasn't just that they saw the Beis HaMikdash destroyed. They saw Shu'alim Hilchubo, like the Pasuk says in the end of last night's Megillah, the end of the Eicha. Shu'alim Hilchubo, right? There were foxes. There were animals. Not only is it devoid of human presence, but there are animals there. I'm just going to get the book. I need to turn over. Because of Soloveitchik, related something very interesting. This is the book, The Lord is Righteous in All His Ways, page 296. Someone once told me an experience he had that was later published as a short story. In 1945, right after he was liberated from the Nazis, on the first high holidays after Lithuania was conquered by the Russian force and liberated from Nazi rule, he returned to Vilna, where he had lived before it was occupied by the Germans. It is very hard to describe what Vilna used to look like on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. In one neighborhood, there were 8 or 9 shuls that had minyanim. There were old synagogues, the Sfarad synagogues, Chassidish synagogues, other synagogues. One synagogue was called Der Kalte Shul, the cold shul. Not because they were lit locks, but because they could not heat it. They couldn't heat it, so they couldn't daven there in the wintertime. The oldest of them were the Beis Knesses Hagro, an old shul that dated back to the Middle Ages, another shul. This person remembered what the shulhoif, the area where all the shuls were congregated, looked like on Yom Kippur night. Tens of thousands of Jews used to come daven in these shuls on the night of Kol Nidre. Everyone used to come. Who didn't go to shul on Yom Kippur night? But this time when he was there, everything was quiet and silent, and he didn't see a single soul. On that Kol Nidre night, he went to the shul where his mother used to daven to see what it looked like now after the Holocaust. And he used an expression found in the kinnah, one of the kinnos towards the end, Mi'itein Roshi Mayim, to describe his feeling. Where is the Torah and the Talmud and those who studied it? Behold, her place is desolate with none to dwell therein. And then he told me a strange story. His mother was an Erlich HaYidna, a pious Jewish woman, as all Jewish mothers were so many years ago. And of course, on Yom Kippur, she used to go to shul to daven. She had a cat, and when it came time for Maftir Yonah, she used to leave the shul to go home and feed the cat. After all, a cat is not obligated to fast on Yom Kippur. The cat used to wait for her, and after she got through feeding it, she went back to shul. This man, who was a boy, knew this cat. And that year, he spent the whole day in the home where his parents had lived. And at about 4:30, at the time when his mother used to feed the cat during Maftir Yonah, the cat scratched at the door. You see, said the Rav, when a place is desolate, it is tragic. But when a place is desolate of human beings, but animals prowl around it, it is almost unbearable. The Pasuk in Eicha, Har Tzion, Sheshamim, Shu'alim Hilchubo, Mount Zion is desolate, no one is there. But although it's painful, I can still bear it. Right? Har Tzion Shashamein, that we can tolerate. But the verse continues and it says, not only are not people not there, but foxes, Shu'olim Hilchubo, the fox or the cat, prowls around. All he saw were the remnants of the shuls and the cat walking among the debris and the ruins of the shuls. And this was almost unbearable pain. And this event had a traumatic effect on him and so on and so forth. And that's the picture that the Rav describes in the Kin. And that's what you have to feel when you visit Poland and you imagine what once was in this place. However, the positive thing is that it's not shualim. It's not, they're not just foxes now. There are Jews. We davened in the shul with minyanim when we were there. Not everywhere, of course, but in some of the main areas in Krakow. I'll mention this also, you know, how many people appreciate it. Think about it. It's I thought it was a very unusual experience. We were there. It was Shabbos Parshas Parah. So first of all, the shul where everybody davened is not the Rambam. The Moshe shul is very small. And there were a lot of Jews there that Shabbos. So there was a minyan in what's called the Izak shul, one of the big shuls, those who have been there may remember. It's a large shul in that area. It's not far from the Rambam shul. And that's where we davened Shabbos. And again, you had in that shul every which type of Jew. There was a large Hasidic contingent. There were boys, again, MTA students. And there were yeshivish guys. And there was Israelis, open white shirts, and knit yarmulke, whatever you had. And everybody was davening together. Literally, hundreds and hundreds of people. I was very proud that after Meir was over and we were leaving the shul, our boys started to dance. Everybody joined in. Again, all kinds of different groups. It was a very, 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 very beautiful moment. So in Shabbos, I don't know who the Gabbai was who was in charge. On Shabbos morning, the Baal Shachris was a Chassidish fellow, and it was Parshas Parah. So some shuls, not around here that I know of, not even my shul, but some shuls have a tradition to say what's called Yotzros, certain additional tefillas, and the Chassidim, they still do it. So Chassidim say, and I think in Breuers they also, they say Yotzros on certain special Shabbos, such as Parshas Parah. So the Baal Shachris was a Chassidish guy, so he, right at the appropriate time, he began Yotzros. And I explained to the boys what this was, because none of them had ever seen it before. The Baal Musaf was an Israeli fellow who had an open white shirt, the knit yarmulke, and he got up and davened to the Baal Musaf, and he said the Tefillah L'Shalom HaMedina, you know, the prayer for the welfare of the state of Israel. So I remember wondering at the time, and still when I spoke to other people, if there was any other shul anywhere in the world where they said both Yotzis in the morning and Tefillah L'Shalom HaMedina. Those two don't go together. You have to go to Krakow to find that experience. To Krakow of today, you know, I found it very, very, very remarkable. I just want to close with a fascinating story. This was a young lady that we met in the JCC in Krakow. We met two young ladies that spoke to our group. This is in addition to the Holocaust survivor and the family that saved the people and so on and so forth. And the woman who's running this forum for dialogue. She said, two girls, one of whom had just found out that she was Jewish. She explained to us less than half a year before, we were there in March, she said in January, she just found out she was Jewish, 19 years old, and had become part of this JCC and was interested in so on and so forth. The other girl, a girl named Elizabeth, and you know, this was subsequently published, so I was able to print it out. Here's her story, and this is basically what she told us, and I'll read it to you. Ever since I was a child, I knew I was Jewish. I also knew I could never reveal my Jewish identity. It is hard to believe that in the 21st century, a Jew still has to hide their Jewishness. But that is exactly what I went through growing up in Dnepropetrovsk in the Ukraine for the last 20 years. Yes, officially there is Jewish life in the Ukraine, and yes, thousands of Jews live in 10 synagogues and Jewish cultural centers in my hometown. But trust me that tens of thousands still fear the repercussions of revealing to the outside world that they are Jewish. And that's what I said before. There were these Poles now who are coming out that they're Jewish and discovering that they're Jewish. My story is one of those who are afraid to reveal that we're Jewish. And only when I moved to Krakow, Poland, was I able to understand how crazy my situation was, that in this day and age, I was forbidden to tell anyone my secret. What happened? That is the happy ending of this sad tale. I'll speak about it later. My first memory of Judaism was very positive. I felt special. I was proud. I was 6 years old, and I knew I was part of this special club, and I just wanted to let everyone know. She had a very identifiable Jewish name. Her name was Elizabeth Schwartzman. It's a Jewish name, Schwartzman, right? So on the first day of school, when the teacher asked every child to introduce themselves and say something interesting about themselves, I have a pony, I like ice cream, I'm left-handed, with a big smile on my face, I stood up and I said, I am Jewish. My teacher's face soured. The exercise ended immediately, and we were all told to go to our seats and open our textbooks. Okay, that's enough personal information for today. Let's go on to the lesson. That night, my parents sent me down and told me how disappointed they were to receive a phone call from the principal complaining of my bad behavior. I didn't understand at the time. I'm not sure I understand today as a woman of 22. So we're talking about now. This is, you know, less than 20 years ago. I followed my father's orders and never mentioned it to my friends again. Until I was 14, when I had my first love in high school. His name was Dimitri, and we were in love together. We spent much time having fun, going out, cherishing each other's company. I was convinced that Dimitri, as many 14-year-old girls are, that Dimitri is my one true love, and so I cautiously revealed him to my secret. I'm a Jew. Dimitri thought nothing of it until that evening when he told his parents. The next day I called him, as usual, to say hello. No answer. I sent emails. No response. Finally, I confront him at his home, where I'd been countless times, and cried out to him, "What happened? You haven't gotten back to me. What's going on?" His response sent shivers down my spine to this day. "Never talk to me again, Eliezer. You are disgusting, your people are evil, and I wish you were dead." I didn't understand. I don't understand. How was I different? Did he have any idea what a Jew was? I had no idea I was Jewish. How could he? How could he say he loved me yesterday and he hated me today? I was and still am so confused. I was crushed but not destroyed. I couldn't explain it, but I would not let the hate defeat me. I would not hide my identity. I would embrace it. I decided to change my name. Because my father was so nervous about anti-Semitism, instead of giving me his name, Schwarzman, as my surname, which was customary, he had me adopt my mother's surname, which was not so identifiably Jewish, so as to hide my Jewishness. In Ukraine, when a child turns 16, they have the choice to choose their original name or to change their name. I became Yelya Zvata Elizabeth Schwarzman, and I proudly showed my identity card to my father. He was shocked, but deep down I believe he was proud. I still did not know what Judaism was about. My father said he would never take me to synagogue, he would never celebrate the holidays, and never have anything Jewish in the house. Except one day, which I found out was Passover. He gave in and finally brought me to the synagogue. It was amazing. I was so happy to see something about my heritage. I had a million questions to understand what the service was about, what the holiday meant to the Jewish people. After that, because of my own growing interest in Jewish traditions or other reasons, my father never took me to the synagogue again. Fear, hate, terror. These words hovered over my father with a name like Schwarzman, and he honestly thought he was doing what was best for me by closing off Judaism to me forever. He decided to send me to school where he thought would be the last place that a Jew could live openly and learn about Judaism. Where? The graveyard of the Jewish people, the ghost of European Jewry's past, Krakow, Poland. And he was right. For the first 3 years of my schooling there, I was in the university, I saw no Jews, encountered no synagogues, and just focused on my studies. Something was gnawing at me that there must be some Judaism, but I was in the strict orders not to engage. I obeyed, until 10 months ago, a day which changed my life forever. Again, it was written this year. I knew only one thing about Judaism in Krakow, that every year was a Jewish culture festival. I mentioned it before. I wasn't sure there were any Jews, but every summer at the university, my friends would go and volunteer at this festival for 10 days in July. The volunteers were called machers. I didn't know why. The festival was started by a non-Jew 25 years ago in an attempt to resuscitate Jewish culture in Krakow, a city in which Jewish life flourished for close to a millennium. It became wildly successful and a symbol of what had been taking place in Krakow, in particular in Poland in general, over the last year since it became an independent democratic state, like I mentioned before. There has been a deep curiosity about Judaism and a willing to showcase Jewish culture in festivals, museums, theaters, and studies. 10 years ago, the Institute for Jewish Studies Department at the major university opened, and today there are 150 students. And that Jewish festival now boasts 25,000 visitors every summer. I decided to become a volunteer, a macher. And as part of our training, we were told we would have a meeting with a rabbi in the Jewish Community Center of Krakow. I'd never met a rabbi before, so I was excited and nervous. The rabbi seemed nice and spoke about what it means to be Jewish and how we could help out people and talk to them about their Jewish culture. Then he finished with one more line, quote, "Krakow is experiencing a rebirth of Jewish life, and particularly here at the JCC, where Jewish life is thriving. If you have a Jewish mother or father, grandmother or grandmother, you could not only be a volunteer at this festival, but you are welcome to join the Jewish community. Just meet me after this talk, and I can help you come back to your heritage." Close quote. Wow. Did he just say there's Jewish life in Krakow? I thought to myself. Could I really become part of the Jewish community? I went home and looked for my documents, my Jewish identity papers, my card with my Jewish name, and the next day I went to the JCC at 9 in the morning to wait for the rabbi and asked for to join the Jewish world. The rabbi was late. He was praying at synagogue, I was told. So I waited nervously and finally met, and he invited me immediately for Shabbos dinner. Since that day, I have not stopped learning. I want to know everything about what it means to be a Jew. I want to try every holiday, every commandment and experience, all that had been denied to me in the Ukraine. I study Hebrew on Wednesdays. I go to Shabbos dinners on Friday nights. I joined the students club and met Jewish young adults my age. Each day is a new wonder. I study with the rabbi four times a week, and I'm entranced by the Bible and Jewish law. Last week, I observed Shabbos for the first time, and it was thrilling. But when she spoke to us, she said it was the fifth Shabbos. This was four weeks before we were there. She told us that this was on a Friday afternoon. This Shabbos was going to be her fifth Shabbos. I was asked about what the experience for me that has been like, and my response that Judaism for me in the Ukraine was like seeing a world in black and white. In Krakow, I see everything in majestic, beautiful color. I'm so grateful to God for giving me the opportunity to return to the Jewish world, and I'm grateful to the JCC of Krakow for being this amazing place of openness and exploration. I hesitantly told my father about my choice to be engaged, to become an active member of the Jewish community. Despite everything, he allowed me to make my own choice, but told me to be careful. It is hard to change stereotypes. It is hard to change what you believe about others, but to change what you think about yourself is even more complicated. I'm convinced that my father will ultimately come around and see how happy I am and how it really is safe to be openly Jewish in Poland today. Today, I proudly say something I only dreamed about for most of my life. Hi, my name is Elizabeth, and I am Jewish. How many people are there like that? What do we do with these Jews who are there, who lived a hidden life for a good part of their lives and are interested in coming back? Is Poland the graveyard of Jewish history? Yes. 3.5 million, a staggering number, more than 10% of the Polish population, more than half those who perished in the Holocaust, Polish Jews. Do we mourn? We go to Auschwitz and Majdanek and we're staggered by what we saw without question. The cemeteries of great tzaddikim and talmid chachamim of the past are all over Poland. Ramo, far from the only one, of Tzaddik and Melachim, and in Warsaw, Chaim Soloveitchik and the Netziv, and great people whom we quote all the time. Their graveyards are in Poland. But evidently, there is some interest in Jewish life in Poland today. And right now, it struck me, anyway, when we think about the 21st century, that at least at the moment, there's some bright hope. I mentioned last night, with this I'll conclude, I mentioned last night that Tisha B'Av, I'm introducing the kinnis on my shul here last night, that Tisha B'Av is a sad day, but it's not a day of despair. A Jew cannot despair. We don't give up. We've suffered, we mourn the tragedies, we're sad, and we recall them, but we don't give up. And I pointed out today, so many of the kinnis have in the conclusion that not one day something's going to be different. Chadesh HaMinuk HaKedem, the Megillah ends. And so many kinnis end on a positive note. Yes, we have to think of the tragedies and express our fury at those Poles who did participate willingly in giving Jews over and seizing Jews' property and killing Jews also. But at the same time, as in Yad Vashem, to acknowledge those who risked their lives, and it was a risk to their lives, make no mistake about it. This woman described it very clearly. I mean, if you were caught, you know, with Jews, it was, you know, they didn't ask questions, you were shot. I mean, there's nothing to discuss. So why should anybody? We can all ask ourselves what we would have done in that situation. Okay, I don't think the answer is necessarily so simple for everybody. But in any event, we express that, and we express the sorrow for the past. But there seems to be at least a flicker of sunshine. And sometimes after the darkest time comes the light. There is a Yerushalmi in the beginning of Maseches Brachos, which speaks about two Rabbanim who were going up a mountain called Mount Arbel. Maybe some of you have been there. It's right outside of Tveria. It's a popular hike. And you can see the Kinneret and so on. So these two Rabbanim, the Gemara Yerushalmi and Brachos describes, were standing on Mount Arbel, and they saw the sunrise from there. And those who have seen sunrise know it's not that it's dark and suddenly it's light. But first you see a few flickers, a few rays on the horizon, and then a few more flickers, and then you see the horizon, you know, if the whole horizon is yellow, then finally you see the ball of the sun. It's a process. Kimo, kimo is the language of the Gemara. Step by step, piece by piece. So one Rav and these two Rabbanim are watching the sunset, and one said to the other, Kachi Geulasan Shel Yisrael. That's how the redemption of the Jewish people is. You come to a dark, dark point, a very dark point. But after the dark point, there's a flicker of light here, and there's a flicker of light there, and there's a ray of light here, and a ray of light there. Little flickers here and there. There's still plenty of darkness for a while. There's plenty of darkness. But there's that flicker of light before eventually the whole horizon, and eventually the sun rises. That's Geulasan Shel Yisrael. Maybe what happened in Poland is a siman that Geulasan Shel Yisrael is near. Not to say that everything's perfect, not to say that there isn't anti-Semitism. I mentioned again last night that we live in a time where anti-Semitism is on the rise in many places. Perhaps in Poland less so than other places of Europe, as irony and as history would have it, but the fact is that it's there. Nonetheless, there's flickers of hope, and Kachi Gulasim Shel Yisrael, Kima Kima, slowly but surely, and we wait the day when the sun will rise completely and the Gula will be complete. Thank you for listening.